Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the 2017 Home Education Conference, held in Williamsburg, Virginia.
Don't let high school writing scare you. How does that sound for a good topic? Very good. Today we're going to talk a little bit about a tactic for tackling academic writing, and we're also going to talk about the unique nature of high school instruction in general. As I've shared before, I have five adult kids, so I've worked with them through high school, but we've also educated thousands and thousands of high school kids through our Brave Writer online writing classes. And we have a particular viewpoint about academic writing. One of the issues with academic writing that intimidates a lot of parents is that they've watched school kids as though they are needing to be prepared for this academic moment of the expository essay or the research paper, and they keep moving backwards when that instruction starts. So whereas when I was in school in the 70s, we didn't really learn how to write essays until high school. Now they start them in like third grade learning the five paragraph format. Have you all seen this?
Yes.
Okay, a couple of things about that. It's absurd, first of all, to assume that putting something in five paragraphs somehow prepares you for academic writing. The academic brain or mindset, academic task, is all about analysis. And just because something is organized with supports doesn't mean that you're doing analysis. All it means is that you're actually putting your thoughts into an organized format with support. The notion that is being taught in most of these classes is this idea of topic sentence, three supporting sentences, and a clincher all gathered around a single idea, maybe with or without a little bit of research. They might look something up somewhere and include that information. But what essay writing is actually about is the capacity to examine multiple viewpoints simultaneously and then generate your own insight, create your own point of view. And literally, until puberty, your kids' brains can't do it. There is this chemical wash. Don't ask me to explain it because I'm not a doctor or a biologist. But what I know from research is that there is a chemical wash that happens in the brain that creates the capacity for holding complexity and ideas in tension. That doesn't happen until after puberty. So a lot of times we even have parents who want their kids to start early, take some of our classes for high school early, and we don't let them because literally their kids aren't ready for the kind of thinking that goes into the writing. So you can train the writing, but the writing's the least interesting part of the essay. The most interesting part is the thinking. And what doesn't get taught is the thinking. What you're doing with your kids by having these conversations and asking these questions and spending time reading and investigating this big world of ideas is you're actually preparing them for that moment when the brain flips over and then they know, oh, there's this whole world of ideas and I get to have a viewpoint about them and I get to explore how to support that viewpoint. And if they are free, natural writers, kids who feel comfortable with the pen and the page, you can literally teach the essay format on the back of a napkin. In fact, the essay format is free online everywhere. If you type in expository essay format, it will come up for you, and you can save yourself money because the format is everywhere. So why is it so hard for kids to write essays? Because they haven't been taught the thinking, and they haven't become comfortable with writing. So my contention, what our theory is in Brave Writer, is that if we help kids become comfortable with writing and we introduce them to the feast of ideas, like Charlotte Mason says, they will be ready when that moment occurs to employ all of that toward having a viewpoint, toward having an insight. We want to teach them to generate insight. So here's why you don't have to let high school writing scare you to start with. You're already doing all the kinds of preparation you need to do for high school right now if you're reading, writing, and creating a language-rich environment. Literally, what you're doing is enough. Somebody asked me about grammar programs, and I didn't mention it, and I want to mention it here. In Brave Writer, we don't have a specific grammar program. We teach grammar in the context of living literature with the arrow and the boomerang. We teach it according to the inductive properties of a specific passage. So we look at a passage and we identify things like verbs or adverbs. But we do it in service of power in writing. So I'm less interested in just saying that's a verb. I'm more interested in saying, why does that verb hold my attention? What kinds of verbs communicate information or experience or emotion that make me want to keep reading? So we look at grammar that way. That said, there's some value to studying grammar. Do it once in elementary school, once in junior high, and teach a foreign language in high school if you can. What program? Well, here's what I say about grammar programs. Pick anyone you like because they're all equally ineffective. Kids don't retain it anyway. So the point of teaching grammar in those years, in elementary school and junior high, is to introduce them to the notion of grammar. What is grammar? Language has a structure and it can be discovered and explored and named. But that doesn't actually improve writing. What improves writing is reading really good writing, reading good diction, and getting an ear for how the language holds together. Once they study a foreign language, everything they learn there will backdate to English. So you can sort of relax a little bit. Teaching grammar every year like they do in school isn't necessary, and the only reason they do it every year in school is it never sticks. It's Teflon. Kids don't think at that level of abstraction. 8-year-olds are not thinking at that level of abstraction. It's an absurd proposition. So yeah, you can use grammar, you know, what is it, the Schoolhouse Rock songs. You can introduce them to those notions, and they may retain some of it if you have a good hook, but that isn't the make or break on teaching writing. And so the same with high school. When you're in this high school moment, yes, you can teach an advanced grammar program, but I'd even more prefer it if you teach them a language, because foreign language instantly disorients you, and you must know grammar to organize a sentence. Native speakers speak intuitively. They go by their ear. I'm not using rules to construct sentences. I'm using what sounds right. And yes, every region has some things that sound right that are not accurate for written writing. But that number is usually pretty small, and that can be taught quickly. Whereas studying all of grammar to try and make sure you don't say don't instead of doesn't is a lot of work and not nearly as helpful to writing. Does that make sense? So then when you go to foreign language, you have to use grammar to construct those sentences, the rules, and suddenly now you understand English on a whole new level. All right? Okay. So there are three trade secrets for academic writing. These, here they come. Whatever you don't teach to your kids is going to be covered in freshman composition. Okay? So if you really blow it, just say to your kids, I love you, sorry, I'll hand you off to, you know, Professor Wilson. They're going to take care of it. Freshman composition today in most colleges starts as though kids don't know how to write. Don't you think that's interesting? And yet you're all worried about what they're learning in high school. I will tell you, I teach freshmen at Xavier, and these are kids who often come from private, very good Catholic schools, and about half my students don't know how to write. They know how to type. They know how to take quotes out of the reading and stick them in the middle of a bunch of words, but they haven't developed a viewpoint. They don't know how to generate insight. They don't know how to analyze. They just know how to sequence paragraphs. So freshman composition in the college setting is all about helping students learn to think so that they can write more effectively. Yeah.
Better grade. So he learned and he's thriving.
That's awesome. So much of what happens in those classes is just helping you understand basic skills, like how to identify credible versus not credible research, how to format, how to think about whether you're analyzing or you're defining or you're narrating, like these different styles of writing. And they do some very good writing in freshman comp. But almost in every other discipline, they are so lax about format, you would be shocked. I'm actually always frustrated by it because I'm in a theology department where they would say things like, well, it's not English class. And I'm like, well, why is English class breaking their hearts over, you know, these details saying it will matter, but every other department doesn't really care? Like, it's ironic. So part of what you want to focus on then is just this energy around thinking and less around all these formats. Secondly, academic writing has a very short lifespan in your child's life. If they live till they're 80, the only 8 years they'll be doing it is high school and college, unless they go to grad school, and only if they go in the field of humanities, and by then, that means they like writing. So if they are just your garden variety kid who isn't loving writing and not going into the humanities, 8 years of academic writing. And yet from the day they enter kindergarten in the school system, they act like that is the pinnacle, you know, the Mount Everest of good writing. What writing are we all using every day? Internet writing, email, texting. That's the dominant part of their lives. We want them to be good at that. I'm actually doing a talk for the teens on Thursday called Teens and Technology, and I'm going to show them why they are the best generation of writers ever in the history of humankind because of the internet, contrary to what everyone else says about them, because I don't buy it. So academic writing is a very short lifespan. So tell your kids, look, we're doing this because we have this 8-year commitment, and then we're done. Treat it like it is. It's just not the most important kind of writing they'll ever do. And then finally, I want to give you a secret. We're going to teach you what I call the principle of three, rather than endless formats. Because there's this notion that a compare, contrast, definition, narrative essay, that each of these are somehow really different animals. Or that timed essay writing and writing a research paper or a master's thesis, that each one is so different, you have to be taught them. And it's actually not true. Academic writing has a certain architecture to it, almost like a skeletal bone structure. And once you kind of understand that and internalize it, then you can modify and suit the material to that structure and have successful writing. And you don't even have to be a brilliant writer to make this work for you. So that's what we're going to do. Here's the goal: to give your students experience with academic formats while fostering the development of their critical thinking skills through writing. That's your goal in high school. I'm going to read it again. To give your students experience with academic formats while fostering the development of their critical thinking skills through writing. The thinking skills, in case you haven't picked this up from me yet, that's the whole deal. That's the most important thing you can do for your kids, is help them become good thinkers, good critical thinkers, people who are not afraid of complexity. And that shows up already in your kids. They are already willing to face complexity. It's just so often we don't see where that complexity is showing up in their teenage relationships. If you don't think teenage relationships are complex, your memory is short. All of the little social dynamics, and whether you like a photograph or not, and if somebody texted someone and someone else texted first, and what does that mean? Lot to sort through there. Just navigating all of the changes, the hormonal changes, the body image changes, their role out in society versus home in their families. They're also encountering, usually for the first time at this age, viewpoints that are not the family viewpoints. And in some cases, they're attracted to those viewpoints and they don't know what to do about it. It's the first time that they're actually expanding their world to include views that aren't their parents. And that's shocking. And it can be as minor as, hanging out a lot with somebody else's family, and just the style of how they do meals or run the household is so different that it changes how this child thinks about their own family. I'll give you a really silly example. My daughter, Johanna, was staying with her friends on a regular basis. They were really best friends, swapping houses, and this was right around the beginning of high school. And suddenly, there were spiders. They found these spiders in the house, and the mom went and got a fly swatter, and she just killed them all. Just boom, boom, boom. And Johanna came home, and she said, "Mom, they killed spiders in their house." I said, "Oh, wow." She goes, "They don't know?" And I said, "I guess they don't. We never kill spiders. We rescue them and send them to the garden because they eat the mosquitoes. I mean, doesn't everyone know this?" Apparently not. Johanna was startled. This was a viewpoint she wasn't anticipating as expressed in action in this family. And that's a very minor story, but I give that to you as a window of insight. This is what starts happening. Of course, I knew other people killed spiders. It just never occurred to me to tell my children, when you get out in the world, be prepared for the people who kill spiders. You know, like that just didn't dawn on me. So what I want you to be aware of is that sometimes that's what's starting to happen, and we want that. We want them to grow their brains and to experience that complexity. So while they're growing up, we can use some of these formats to help them grow their critical thinking skills. When Noah was, he's my oldest, when he was a freshman in high school and wanted to play all these, you know, role-playing online games, which back then seemed more terrifying to me than they do today, we had him do his first essay on that topic, and he and I did research together, and I wanted to learn what he knew about whether or not those were dangerous to his well-being. My lovely, almost 30, somewhat pacifist son, who shot all kinds of things for years. So that's what we wrote about. So that's the goal. So I would like to introduce you to what I call the rhetorical imagination. In other words, dressing up the mind. And this is Katrin over here, my daughter. This is my front door. That's her best friend. For a year, Katrin had a fashion blog. And every day for 365 days, she wore a new outfit and took a picture of herself in front of our house and then wrote a little blog under it. And she had a business selling cookies to buy clothes at the thrift store, just to give you some ideas of what kids do at this age who are homeschooled. But I love, you know, I think of dressing up the mind. So, of course, I thought of her dressing up all the time. But the point is this. The rhetorical imagination, this phrase that I've coined, is the combination of rhetoric-level thinking with creativity. We're so busy thinking about academic thinking as though there's a right and a wrong. But if any of you are currently watching that television show Genius about Albert Einstein on National Geographic Channel, or you've studied any of the great scientists, everything is about creativity. Like, there is no field. Mathematics is about creativity. Computer programming is about creativity. It's about the imagination. What you're able to envision, imagine, conceive that hasn't been thought of before. It's that ability to generate insight. And so at this stage, your kids are just for the first time having a bit of a rhetorical imagination moment. They are able to know that multiple viewpoints exist, and some of those are in conflict, and they have to think through and resolve that in some way. Her family kills spiders, my family doesn't. What does that mean? PETA shows me videos of animals being tortured. I'm going to be vegan. My mom won't be vegan too. What does that mean? You know, when Johanna switched over to veganism and I didn't switch with her, I said I'd support it, but I wasn't going to, she burst into tears. You saw the videos, Mom. How are you not converting over? This is the beginning of that. She has to create, they have to grow the capacity to hold multiple points of view simultaneously and not self-destruct, not combust. And just to go even a little darker, some of teen suicide and depression is when they aren't given enough space to have multiple perspectives. They're encountering something they don't know how to deal with, and all that's happening is it's being shut down. So part of this birth of the rhetorical imagination should really excite you, but it's also a little scary because they'll go places that you didn't expect them to go. They're going to think about things you didn't think your sweet little cherub would ever think about. And this is actually a valuable tool for academics. So that's where we want to harness it. We want to use it to really grow that mind and strengthen it. It includes ideas, insight, viewpoints, powerful associations, the ability to take, you know, a Star Wars metaphor and borrow it into a great essay about a work of literature. Complexity, we've explored a lot. And then empathy, the capacity to recognize that that viewpoint that isn't mine makes sense within the confines of that person's experience, right? Like, people are not illogical. If you really knew where they were coming from all the way down, they make sense. But when we're only in ourselves, we can't see it. So this is a moment where kids are reading and discovering other viewpoints and starting to recognize how life looks from the inside of that person, inside their skin. So I call this the great brain shift. And what we're trying to do is grow a mind. We want our kids to know that's what's happening. You get to tell them this. It's not a secret. It's not just something you know. It's something they get to know. So you can say things like, we're going to read, you know, this piece about the way Native Americans understand what's going on with the Keystone Pipeline. And then we're going to read this piece over here about how Exxon understands our need for petroleum. And then we're going to talk about our family's relationship to that area because we live here and we're not allied with either group, and yet how this will impact our community. And then you actually tell them, and this is going to help our brain grow. It's going to help you start to have a bigger, more expanded mind. That's the kind of thing you want to do at this age. That is the most valuable thing you can do in high school on any level. Now, if you want your kids to write about a subject and you want to start to investigate something controversial, do not start with your family's most sacred viewpoints. Okay? Do not, because it will be painful for you. You don't want to hear your very pro-life family have a child argue for the pro-choice position. It might be too painful for you. So I always say pick something a little more benign, like let's say your child's an indoor rock climber or just an outdoor rock climber. You can type anything into Google with the word controversy and something will come up. So I remember we typed in rock climbing controversy. Noah was a rock climber. And immediately what came up was this location in Lake Tahoe, California, that was a beloved place for rock climbers that also had ties to a Native American burial ground. It wasn't the ground, it was adjacent. And they didn't want rock climbers on it, and it was a huge controversy in California with lawsuits and all these, totally fascinating. So now here you have something where neither of us had a stake in either side, and we could examine it together and look at the validity of arguments on both sides and try on for ourselves what those were like. And yet it was still tied to something he cared about, which was rock climbing. Do you see what I mean? So this is the kind of thing you can be doing with your kids. Help them grow their minds. Yes?
How old do you start teaching, like, empathy?
Well, I think empathy starts at birth, you know, so it's responsiveness to babies, etc. But when we're talking about this active kind of empathy where you're pulling in outside viewpoints, I would go around high school. We usually say in Brave Writer, when you see them grow hair, lower their voice, you know, like those puberty signs, that's when you can engage this stuff. What we've also found is if we have kids who are like 12 or 13 and you go too quickly to that stuff, it's destabilizing. Like they can get unhappy or they get very dogmatic. They can still get kind of dogmatic as teens, but it's a different kind of dogmatism when they're 12 and 13. It's more like, it's not possible. Whereas at 16, it's more like, I am right. You know, it's like, it's a slight difference. Yeah. So that's kind of how does that answer it? Yeah, good. The other thing to let your kids in on is this notion of the great conversation. We talked about it earlier, but I'll explore it more. The great conversation is this idea that civilization stands on the shoulders of men mostly and women who have been building civilization through their skills in education. So most of recorded history has the writings of men. That's why I said men. We know women have been doing their share. They just haven't gotten much credit. But mostly the writings of men, a lot of the research and scientific breakthroughs and all of that have been handed down to us. And it's a global thing. It's not just Western civilization. We can kind of get fixated on that. But we've had this global eruption, especially in the last century, where everybody is contributing to this human project, this idea that, you know, 10 billion people can share a planet. And when we're talking with our kids about what they're reading, what we're saying to them is, hey, you're eavesdropping. This conversation is like happening in this room adjacent to us, and we're just going to like listen in, hear what they're saying, think about those ideas, consider it against our experience. And over time, in a specific discipline, you will master that vocabulary. You will start to know, what are the contours of this field? How do we talk about the things this field cares about? And that language is going to change over time. I was watching this Albert Einstein Genius series, and one of the ideas that was common at the beginning of the 20th century was that light traveled to us through something invisible called the ether. And the ether was a theory, and it didn't hold up. It ended up falling apart. And that was being taught at the top universities at the time. So it's okay to tell your kids that, too. A lot of what's out there, we're exploring. We're at cutting edges. We're considering. We're reconsidering. And each generation gets to do that. It's the right and privilege of each generation to overturn the work of the previous one. We don't always have to hold quote unquote, faithful. We are making contributions. That is part of the role of each one of us. So we have these big, juicy conversations. We read literature that's nonfiction, fiction, poetry, research, ancient, modern. Try and read something from everything if you can. It's great too. It's good to be exposed to a lot of things. And then let's look now at this Think Three principle. There is something about the number three. I know a lot of you here are Mormons. There's, you know, the Trinity, first of all. But then there's three tenors, three sides to a triangle, three little pigs, three scoops of ice cream. And there are basically three academic writing formats. And since we love all these other things, I thought I'd put the academic formats right in there, the three scoops of ice cream. Here they are. There is basically one essay format that comes in two flavors, persuasive and exploratory, and they have all their own sort of add nuts and chips flavors, right? So, you know, you could have a persuasive compare and contrast, or you could have an exploratory compare and contrast. You could have a definition paper that's exploratory, or you could have a persuasive paper that's a definition paper. It doesn't necessarily limit you. I don't want you to think in your heads, oh, but I know all these other styles. You do. But the question is, are we exploring the topic or are we making a case? And that's the expository essay. It can be as short as a few paragraphs, and it can be long up to about, I don't know, I'd say expository essays, 10, 12 pages is getting a little long. So maybe around 10 pages max. Then there's the timed essay. The timed essay is what they have to do to get into college. So they take it with the SAT or the ACT. They do it at the semester, you know, during finals, where they're just going to write in class. I was a history major. Most of our finals were in-class essays, in a blue book, longhand. Now, some are still blue book. Some are on computers. Some were on computers and are back to Blue Book because of the obvious risks of computers. I imagine at some point they'll be all on computers and there'll be terminals in the schools. That is not yet the case. A lot of longhand writing. Who has an advantage in longhand timed essay writing? Brave Rider students, because they've been free riding since they were 8 or 9 years old. They're used to a timer, they're used to speed, they're used to thinking and writing. So there's one good reason to do free riding. And then the third writing format that is pretty popular, especially in college, is the longer form. It's a research paper, a thesis, a dissertation. And it is built from the same properties as these other two. So let's start by looking at thesis-based writing, the traditional essay. Does everyone know what a thesis is? I noticed no hands went up. Yes. Okay, so a few of you do. Okay. Thesis. It is a risky claim or a risky proposition. You are making some kind of statement. You know, although raw milk has been found to sometimes contain salmonella, Altadena Dairy has such high standards of sanitation, their raw milk is okay to drink. It's that kind of comment where you are making a claim and you are now going to prove it. So you make this risky proposition, and then you have 3 points to support it, 3 main points, and then you have what Allen and Bacon, the Guide to Writing, call particulars, which are facts, data, expert opinions, statistics, experience, logic, all kinds of particulars to support a point. But the part I want you to notice are the 3 groups of 3. Because this is magically going to become a much longer paper. You don't have to be rigid. I had someone say, well, is it ever okay to write an essay with 4 points? Of course it is, absolutely. It's okay to write an essay with 6 points. But what we consider a unit of proof in academics is 3. There is something about 3 that brings a level of persuasiveness that 1, 2 don't. And sometimes 3 is better than 4 or 5. It really depends on the topic. But what 3 does is it clarifies for you. If I know I have these 3 key points to support this thesis, now I need to think about, well, how do I support that point? And I can look for research or data that will help me do that, and I can pick 3 of those. What I have found when I teach college kids is that too often they're meandering. You probably know this. They meander. They just start writing, and they have some proof over here, and then they meander into experience, and then they restate the same point. They don't actually have what I would call the architecture of an argument. So if you illuminate this for them, there's still tons of freedom for all that writing, but now there's this skeleton that they're hanging it on. And just as a side note, I don't think it's always beneficial to do this up front. Sometimes you need lots of free writing and then do what I call outlining from behind. You look through all this free writing where they've expressed and expressed, and you go through and start circling possible points. Oh, here's a cluster that would be really good, and it's the best cluster, so let's save it for the end and put it in this emphatic order so the best is saved for last. And then here's something over here, but you know what? It looks to me like you've got 2 really strong ideas, but maybe we still need a 3rd one. Otherwise, you've just got all this writing, and it looks like a lot of volume, but there isn't actually anything there. There's no substance. And you can easily find those points if you're looking for points and then looking for their supports. Does this make sense? And then you will have some form of a conclusion, which is going to restate or add, you know, expand, create a wish, do an application that sort of pulls the whole thing together. So literally, this is the traditional essay, and this is what they think they're teaching in 3rd grade. They're telling them, okay, let's talk about why you love Christmas, you know? And so it's not a risky proposition. It's just more like a little narrative report. And it's like, I love Christmas because I like decorating the tree, I like baking cookies, and I like opening presents. And then they're like, well, we need supports for each. Well, I like decorating the tree. I have a favorite ornament. My mother puts the star on top, and my dad really likes to hang tinsel. You know, and that's, they're building that. And they're telling their kids, okay, well, this is the structure of good writing. It's the structure of good academic writing, but it's not particularly interesting to read, right? So we hope that they're learning all kinds of writing, because this is not what is consumed out in the world. I mean, when was the last time you read an essay of this structure? I mean, anyone? Did you read one this week? Yeah. Are you teaching? Yeah. That doesn't count. But do you see what I'm saying? These packages of information are delivered to professors who've got all kinds of students they've got to engage with. It gives them a quick way to really see, did the material land? They're not looking for flourish in the same way that you are when you're trying to get published. And yet, like I pointed out, it's only 8 years of writing. So this is like explaining to your kids, okay, here's the system they use to show and demonstrate that you understand the material. It also helps clarify for you what you understand from the material. It's not our flashiest writing package. Okay, does that make sense? All right, so what happens then if you're going to write a research paper? Well, imagine an accordion. And think of my 3 points. Oops. Oh, I don't know what happened there. Hold on. That's funny. There we go. Think of my 3 points as those little grooves in the accordion. You're going to have 3 essay-length features within this research topic. So you're going to have a thesis topic, like let's say, you know, antebellum South. And then you're going to have a thesis, an essay-length portion, 3 of them, in this research paper. Think of how daunting it is to think you have to write 15 or 20 pages. But if you knew you were writing 3 essays of several pages, doesn't that immediately feel more manageable? So you're thinking in terms of these 3 kinds of subtopics that are big enough to house your information. And then you've got points, 3 points for each. And then you have 3 particulars for each point. And if you need to grow this, expand it, you're going to use 3 paragraphs to talk about the particulars. You're going to develop the material, comment on it, give it more insight, give it more strength. So if you're thinking of growing a paper from 5 paragraphs to 15 pages, this is how it happens. It's actually like magic. It feels really good when you're in this flow. Because suddenly, you're working through chunks, and you're able to zero in, and you can see where you're weak. You get to a point where you can only find 2 particulars, and really, they're not very good. You suddenly realize, that's not a very good point I was making. I'm married to that point, but actually, there's no support for this point. See what I mean? But that's so much not how it's taught. And let me go to the next, and then you know, the big finish. You have a conclusion that sort of draws it all together. The first time I did this talk at a conference was in Memphis a number of years ago, and they had me scheduled against the comedian. So everyone went to the comedian, and there were 7 people in the audience. And so I'm like, just come in close. So the 8 of us went through this whole talk, and at the end of it, one of them was a man, a dad, and he goes, I cannot believe you just gave this talk. I said, why? He said, I'm writing my dissertation. I'm a PhD student, and I've made it all the way through school, my entire career, and no one has explained this to me. And I was totally struggling with my dissertation, and while you were talking, it just clarified in my mind. Isn't that amazing? And I was like, I don't know why it's not taught, but it's logical. Now, the danger of a format is if it's wooden, right? And university professors hate that. Here's what I feel like we do in Brave Writer, and this is why I like what we do, obviously, is this. We get you comfortable with writing your own insight, your own voice from 5 years old till about 14, so that when you start writing essays, all of that is available to you. The structure now is just the architecture for how you're going to deliver your voice. That's true. No, that's absolutely true. This is definitely humanities-based writing. Yeah. And the social sciences have slightly different protocols as well. They use a different style guide. They don't like first person, whereas the humanities, ever since the 90s, the first person's in everything. The social location's really important. But this is the basic structure of support, and I like that you said that about grant writing and business proposals, because that's true. I think one of the gifts we can give our kids when we're working with all this academic material is how to think clearly, how to be able to house that information that they are really excited about. And it doesn't have to be a topic that is, you know, dead and dull. It can be something that they really care about, but whatever it is, having that architecture helps them It helps them know how to present their arguments. Do you guys want to comment, you two college profs over here? Either of you? Yeah. Well, no, that's exactly right. I like that you said that. One of the things that is missing, I think, in high school instruction, and I saw it because I had kids in high schools, is that they always pass the buck backwards. So they'll say, well, you should have learned this last year, and then they just go on. And that happens over and over again on every level in writing. It's because people aren't as comfortable instructing the idea generation piece. They are more comfortable in the format piece. But what I've noticed in homeschool is there's so much anxiety around the format piece that if I can just like cool the temperature, like this is it. This is it. This is the big mystery that you think's happening that you aren't teaching. And what you really want to do is work on that rhetorical imagination piece, the complexity, the reading widely, the having these difficult conversations, the identifying of possible points, the looking up the research to see if those points will stand, if there's enough support to make that point. And then if you've done all that, putting it into this container, a child who knows how to write will be beautiful. It actually will have like the strength and the voice. You know, sometimes Brave Writer gets accused of just being creative writing. And then I always say, well, all writing is creative. Even technical writing is creative. It takes the creative work of finding the right voice for that specific audience, no matter what it is, whether you're writing a manual for how to use Microsoft Word, or you're writing a poem, or you're writing a research paper. Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. And when I was in college, I wrote papers two ways. I either free wrote them, just truly free wrote them, and then what I would do, this is all back before computers, so everything longhand, I'd put little asterisks on the margin, and I'd put 1A, and then I'd get a new sheet of paper and put asterisk 1A, and I'd develop more. And then I would go back and read, oh, I want to develop this point. I'd get another sheet of paper, 2B, and I'd put on another sheet. And literally, I'd be up at night typing on my little Selectric, and I would have all these pages literally cut into pieces, stapled together in order, and type them out. But here's what's valuable about that that you don't get with the computer. I knew that I could do violence to my writing. I could cut it up. I could cross out a word. I could draw an arrow and point over here and add more detail. The computer makes things feel a little official, and you don't have the tactile pleasure of cutting and manipulating. And so you make very cosmetic changes. You don't make wholesale rewrites. So one of the things we're doing in the wacky revision thing tomorrow with the students is we're using scissors and glue. Like literally making them cut up their papers, because then you can outline from behind. So you can take this paper, you know, print it out triple spaced and start moving things around. And you could literally have this form say, well, this works better here and this works better here, and start moving it around. When I was building partnership writing and Jot It Down, two of our products, and Faltering Ownership, I did the same way. I have a room that's pretty empty. I have very little furniture in it. And I literally laid everything on the floor, and I just kept moving stacks, and then shuffling paper. That's how I have to do it. It's like a game. You know, we do this process in Kids Write Basic called Snip and Pin, where literally the kids are going to cut up the sentences and then move them on a bulletin board with pins around until they can get them in the order they like. And you can immediately see what's missing, but because it's freed from the paper and the screen, you can just go type or handwrite a sentence and stick it in there and fix it. Do you see what I mean? So that's partly what this this process does. It gives you a structure to look at how to take all that raw writing and how to organize it. We want our kids to learn about credible sources at this level as well. The hardest thing right now. And everybody has different opinions about what creates credibility. But academic standards basically say this: you want things that are peer-reviewed, you want to be sure that there is research and data that is respected, that backs up a position, not just somebody's, you know, little experiment they did at their house or whatever. It's very difficult today, because students are so used to using the internet that they tend to go to things that are really just glorified blogs. They think they're news agencies or they think they're data collection agencies. So still using government-provided statistics is considered preferable. Things from academic journals and universities. For high school students, when we do writing with them, we don't always require that because they don't always have access. They're just high school kids at home. But we do try to keep them steered towards what would be considered experts in the field. For example, I remember I had a student talking about global warming, and he quoted Tom DeLay, who was a senator. And I was like, yeah, he's a senator. He has an opinion, but it isn't. We don't care about his opinion in this context. We need an expert in science like that. And while I have you here, since some of you are Mormon and or from a religious background, I do want to talk for a moment about religious texts and academic writing. This comes up a lot in homeschool. What we know is this. You can use religious texts in academic writing if the subject matter requires information from that text. And I'll give you an example. Let's say you're writing about the history of Mormonism and you want to include some of those texts that go along with what you're writing about. That's appropriate. The same with, like, I give this example all the time. From the Quran. The Quran has a, they forbid putting animals to sleep. They only allow an animal to die its natural death. So Americans, we're killing our animals all the time. Oh, he's got cancer, I'm going to kill him. But that's not how Muslims feel. So if a Muslim was going to write a paper on why we should not put our animals to sleep, put them down when they're sick, they will not get credibility in an academic context just quoting that verse from the Quran. Why? Because the vast majority of people that they're writing for are not feeling beholden to the Quran. That is equally true with abortion and the Bible. So when we're using a religious text, you can use it to show motivation in an individual. You know, I wrote a paper in college on the Eastern African missionary movement, and I used scripture to show motivation of the missionaries. I didn't use scripture to say all people should be missionaries. Do you see the difference? Is this clear? So I want this to be clear, because what ends up happening is very zealous, very sweet kids go off to these secular universities, and then they write what is more like an apologetic as a paper rather than an academic essay. And what they're doing is they're testing their faith in a secular environment. And they don't need to do that. That's not the purpose of the university. You're only writing for your professor. No one else is reading it. The professor wants you to take a risk and explore something you don't know anything about, not recite what you've learned in your homeschool in an academic context to see if it can fly in a secular university. Does that make sense? Do you understand that? And I say that as someone who's worked in a Catholic university. That's what happens. And we want people to understand that the faith is respected. Even university professors respect faith, but they're looking for an academic style of writing rather than apologetics. And that's usually where the problems happen. Less credible sources: entertainment news, celebrity opinion, sketchy research, blogs, advocacy groups. So if you're on the PETA website, don't quote PETA, but you could cite their outside research. Just, it'd be good to know that it's from the outside. And then we just talked about religious texts. They have a role, but they're just, it's like secondary support. You could, in an ethical, like if you're writing a paper on ethics and you wanted to talk about treatment of animals, you could draw from multiple religious texts to talk about how some of the great religions in the world think about animals and ethics. That would be an appropriate use of religious texts as well. Reasonable expectations. So these are the things you want to get done in high school. And I consider these reasonable expectations. I hope they are. Read a range of literature, American, British, world, and modern. Your kids may have their own tastes. I know Noah was less interested in classical literature, more interested in modern. Johanna was less interested in American, more interested in British and world. And so I catered to those things. It's nice, though, if they do a little bit in each, if possible. Secondly, write several essays, 3 to 5 pages. We do offer essay classes in Brave Writer that make that a pretty painless process. And then I would recommend doing at least one long form paper that has works cited, you know, practice using MLA citations, and that does 5 to 7 sources. We do have an MLA research paper class, but it only takes 10 students. So if it's something you end up wanting to do, you'll want to sign up early.
Or we're
looking mostly for colleges. They're looking for 120 hours per year of reading, writing, listening, speaking, and language. And that sounds like a ridiculous number. I've never once, not once, counted a single hour of my home education. So if you need permission to not count, I'm giving it to you. My kids have all gone to college. What I will say is this. We tend to minimize talking. And talking, like I said, can make up a big part of your education. So make sure you count that. And reading online counts. I mean, some of these kids, they're going down the rabbit hole into incredible subject areas. They just get ravenous. They start reading these long threads on Reddit, and the next thing you know, they're off researching. And I mean, my kids have taught me more things that I never expected to learn because of some rabbit hole on the internet. So these are my 5 kids. This was from Christmas. So this is the student at Columbia. This is Jacob. This is Noah, who is a computer programmer and lives in Cincinnati. This is Johanna on her way to Vietnam. This is Katrin, who is in Pittsburgh. And this is Liam, who's in France coming home Saturday. And they're fun. And so they've all had different high school journeys, and we're at the end, so I'm not going to go into a big long one, but they've all done a little bit of high school. We had some part-time enrollment options in our local school district, but the younger ones went to full-time high school. So both Noah didn't go to high school, so they're kind of like a mixture. And they've all had their own journeys as adults as well, and all the preparation and lack of preparation all worked out. So is that okay? Doesn't that feel better to know that? So if you want to take our online classes, we have some for summer. Registration opens June 5th on a Monday. And then we have summer fall session, and registration opens on August 7th, which is a Monday. Cindy's in the back if you want to talk to her later or me. We've got 15 minutes, I guess, before the next session. We also have a writing manual called Help for High School, which teaches rhetorical imagination plus the expository essay, and then a language and literature program called the Boomerang. So that's it. Thank you.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.